got our hands on the All-22 film for Super Bowl 53, why Belichick's game plan was even better than we thought, how Wade Phillips shut down Brady and company, and the game's real MVP. Plus, we have off-season look-ahead talk, the quarterback market, who's coming up in the draft, and the outlooks for the other 2019 contenders from Indianapolis to New Orleans. It's all on the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. I am Gary Gramling here with Andy Benoit. And Andy, our first topic today, the tape is in.
Do we call it tape? I call it film now. The film is in. Super Bowl's watching. It took me all day on Tuesday. I wasn't planning on watching it Tuesday. I don't know what I thought I was going to do instead. But I got a message saying the system was back up. And so I settled in and it wind up. I spent the whole day on it. I didn't plan on that. It was good. It was really good film, though. That's why it took so long.
The film is in doesn't quite hit your ear the same way.
There is no tape anymore. When I first started, there was tape. NFL Films, you go in there, and there's a wall of tapes, and they would put tapes in, take tapes out, and that's how it rewound, and then they all got on a digital system. But some people still say tape. Tom Brady, I think, says film.
When he wins a 7th Super Bowl, I'll switch to film. But for now, it's tape in my mind. So Andy has indeed broken down the Super Bowl All-22 tape. We're going to talk about that a little bit at the top, and then we will get into some off-season stuff and some of your mailbag questions. But Andy, what's your give me your general take on what you saw.
The general take is that anyone who's telling you it was a sloppy game or boring game, I understand if they say in a boring game, that's just a preference thing, but it was not a sloppy game at all. It was one of the most marvelous defensive battles I think I've ever seen, and you could probably argue, Gary, that it was two of the top 10 Super Bowl defensive performances, if you count each team individually. Certainly New England, I'd put up there as the best that I've seen, just if we're confining it to a Super Bowl. And let me know, maybe I'm overlooking someone when I say that, but for my lifetime, that's the best I've seen. And I would imagine it's one of the two or three best in Super Bowl history. And the Rams were almost just as good as the Patriots defensively.
How well do you remember Ravens over Giants?
Yeah, I was thinking about that one. Yeah.
Giants over Patriots the first time, 18-1.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. And the Giants, what they did is very similar to what New England did, is they came in with a very specific scheme in that game, and that was a double A-gap game, where this was before teams were putting linebackers in the A-gaps with regularity, but Steve Spagnuolo in that 2007 game started doing it with Antonio Pierce, and they got one-on-one blocking for their edge rushers, and New England could not handle the one-on-one blocking. It was Strahan and a bunch of other who else was on that team for the Giants? A lot of the NASCAR front.
Tuck, yeah. Umanyora. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's up there. But what New England did, Sean McVay was right on when he said, I got out, coach. New England suffocated them almost just by the way they lined up, and the execution took care of itself from there. And the Rams were, they never really adjusted. When they did, it was a little too late, obviously. I mean, we can get into the details of it. I don't think I've seen a better defensive performance in the Super Bowl, though.
I mean, we talked on the Monday show, 6-1 front, the six linemen and one linebacker behind it, and that combined with the cover four that the Patriots played. Why was that so effective, Andy?
The 6-1 front takes away a lot of the outside zone game, because outside zone blocking essentially comes down to double teams and combo blocks, and you all move in one direction as a unit, as the O-line, and you work together. Well, if you've got a bunch of one-on-one blocks, which is what you get when there's six defensive linemen up there, then you're not going to get everybody moving in consistent direction, because theoretically they'd all have to beat their defender in the exact same way at the exact same time. So outside zone blocking, the big reveal of this game, Gary, is that those outside zone schemes are dependent on the formation and the defensive structure as much as anything, and you can take it away if you're willing to commit those guys up on the line of scrimmage. And then when they played quarters behind it, that put the safeties in the passing lanes for where the Rams normally throw their play-action routes. And it's no coincidence that Jonathan Jones, their cornerback, slot corner, he played safety on first and second down. They only did the quarters, or cover four, they only did it on first and second down because that's when the Rams throw play-action. When you got into third down, regular dropback situations, the Patriots played a lot of their usual man-to-man principles that we've come to know. They did some nice things out of man-to-man, too. But that was the basis of it. Is they beat? We said all along going into the game, if you beat the Rams on first and second down, you will beat the Rams because they're not designed to win on third down.
You know, R. Kaylin Kaler did a little piece on this the other day on the MMQB. She talked to people around the league, said, you know, it's a game where the Patriots allowed 3 points. Should a wide receiver have won MVP? And she was told along the way that there is, I guess there's a 16-person committee. I'm not sure if that counts the fan vote or not. I don't know if we're going to put a whole lot of stock into the fan vote. But a 16-person committee, no defensive players got MVP votes for this game. But, you know, a couple people around the league that Kalen had talked to said Stephon Gilmore. A couple people said Dante Hightower. After watching the All-22, who would you give your vote to?
Well, it's funny because Jenny Varentes on our staff is one of those voters. I think she's new to the panel. And she was talking to Robert Klemko about who to vote for, and I couldn't quite hear them. And I was sitting next to Connor Orr, and so Klemko and Varentes are two seats down from me. It's Connor Orr right next to me. And I leaned over to Connor, and I said, you just know the voters are going to get lazy and give this vote to Edelman, don't you? Because they're not going to try to sort out the defense. And apparently Jenny had just at that moment said, I think I'm voting for Edelman, to Klemko. So it's, and they thought that was funny. But you know what? People, Jenny, she's put in a tough position there to vote defense in the middle of the game because so much of what a defender does is not reflected on the surface, and it's certainly not reflected in the stat book. So I understand how Edelman did get the vote, and I don't think it's a horrible vote. He did some important things in that game. He was by far the biggest guy in their offense. But once you get a chance to look at the film, and I would not have voted this way after the game, so I would have been guilty of, I don't know who I would have, I probably would have voted Gilmore after the game, but once you look at the
Gilmore a little bit.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. We did. After seeing the film, my guy is Kyle Van Noy, and next would be Hightower, and then probably Gilmore. But Van Noy did, and none of it shows up on stats, but he did everything that made the game plan go. So those six-man defensive lines, he was up on the what amounted to the weak side. He played wherever the tight end was not. He was opposite the tight end. He often walked out over the wide receivers as part of that six-man D-line, and he jammed those receivers. We wondered about that, Gary, if they would jam those tight split receivers. He was very good in backside coverage and space. And then when they got to man-to-man, the pass rush, they featured a five-man pass rush on just about every man-to-man snap. He was the fifth guy in that pass rush, and he did a tremendous job. It was a highly schemed rush with a lot of stunts and twists.
When Chung went down, when Patrick Chung went down with what we presume is a broken arm at this point, how did that change what the Patriots did?
What happened when Chung went down, and I would love to know the Rams, it's probably a function of the Rams having just gotten their hats handed to them, but they went to two tight end sets after that. So Chung had been in, and he was guarding the tight end, and the Patriots were playing their dime package with him. I believe it was dime. But when the Rams went to their two tight end personnel with Higby and Gerald Everett both in, the Patriots went base 4-3. So not a whole lot changed. Hightower just played up on the line of scrimmage where Chung had been playing, and Landon Robertson came off the bench and played the stack linebacker spot that Hightower had been playing. And the first and second down approach, it didn't change a whole lot. On third down, McCourty took over for Chung. They put Chung on Gurley in man-to-man coverage, and McCourty became the guy. They really transitioned well after Chung, but part of it was the Rams made it, frankly, I think they made it a little bit easier on them by going with more of those two tight end sets rather than their usual three wide receiver sets that they had featured in the first half.
Poor Wade Phillips. That's how we'll wrap this up. Poor Wade Phillips. No one's ever going to talk about the time he held Brady's offense to 13 points in the Super Bowl, but how did the Rams pull this off? Because as we said on Monday, and as pretty much anyone who has watched organized football over the past two decades would tell you, if you were going to hold the Patriots to 13 points in the Super Bowl, you feel pretty good about your chances of winning that game.
Oh, which is why Jared Goff and Sean McVay, I'm sure, feel sick. And there's going to be a part. I hear you never get over losing the Super Bowl, but there's going to be an extra part of those guys that really never gets over it because they held Tom Brady to 13 points and their number one scoring offense in the NFL, or their number one overall offense. It got stymied, and that's going to make those guys sick. It's going to probably make Wade Phillips sick too. What they did on the Rams, it's a theme for both sides, and probably, Gary, the reason the game went the way it went was help coverage out of man-to-man, and New England did it as well. So I mentioned that New England did a nice job in their man-to-man. What they did against the Rams, when the Rams went three receivers to a side, which is almost always a bunch, they played straight man-to-man but put an extra safety over there, and the safety picked up whoever got rubbed or picked, because we always say, well, how do you play the switch releases? You get rub routes, pick routes. You can't play man-to-man against it. The Patriots did, and then they put an extra man over there to kind of clean up whatever broke loose or whoever got open. The Rams, they played man-to-man, and their help was always on the inside, down the middle of the field, which is how they've played all season long. And they did a very nice job of disguising their man-to-man, playing to their help. They lined up in zone looks and played man out of it. You never got a beat for who was guarding who. They didn't put the same guys on the same receivers all game long.
I was going to say, could you figure out any pattern with what they were doing? Because we talked about this a little bit on Brady's first pass attempt of the game. It was once Burkhead motioned to the backfield, Peters stayed outside when Edelman was out there, even though we saw a lot of Roby Coleman on Edelman. And on that particular play, we had Roby Coleman move over to, I believe it was Dwayne Allen in the right slot there for right being the offensive side of the ball. And then Roby Coleman, it was a man coverage. He fell off. It was zone coverage. He deflected a ball, and Littleton got the interception.
Yeah, and you're talking that particular play, Gary, was really once everything shook out, it was standard cover three. Tom Brady just made a bad play. He assumed that the hitch route would be open because it's been open all season, and Roby Coleman assumed that Brady would assume that, and he went and jumped the route, and they got the interception. So that one, it was one of the more almost an outlier of the game. The Rams did do a lot of cover three, I guess, in the first half, and they did get to it in different ways. They disguised it. They played different variations of cover three. But as the game progressed, it became more and more about their matchup coverages. And I imagine if you sat Wade Phillips down, he'd say, well, we didn't actually call man-to-man on every snap. It just looked like we did. We had this zone and that zone, and we had matchup principles out of it. Suffice it to say, once the play was concluded, when the dust had settled, the Rams had beaten the Patriots with matchup or man coverage on most of the snaps.
We talked about this a lot in December and January, Andy. The simplistic defensive schemes that allow their players to play fast, and Matt Eberflus in Indianapolis was the guy we sort of highlighted the most on this. And it seems to be sort of an upcoming trend and maybe a solution to the fact that, let's face it, offenses are just running roughshod over defenses right now. But with what the Patriots did, and I'll keep it on the Patriots at this point. You have a veteran defense. You have guys who you can ask them to do different things, and they're comfortable doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that attack going forward? I mean, look, we saw the Colts, Cowboys, Chargers all get knocked out in the conference semifinals, where they kind of got overwhelmed by opposing offenses. Building your defense. Patriots are not overwhelmingly talented on defense. Building a veteran defense that can do a number of different things from week to week. It's a little bit different with the Super Bowl. You have the extra week of preparation, but that's how the Patriots were able to do this.
It is. So, Gary, then I guess what we have to discuss is how are they able to do that? Because we always think, well, you got to go find versatile players, and I'm sure that's part of it. I'm sure that's something they really focus on when they're scouting guys in New England. But Kyle Van Noy was not considered a versatile player in Detroit. I don't know what his scouting report was coming out into the NFL. Do you remember what the book on him was entering the NFL? He was a second-round pick of the Lions.
He was a BYU guy. He was the very general scouting report. He was a capable edge guy, good dropping into coverage.
Okay, which is, that's kind of accurate. It's not quite the player he's become, but that is part of his repertoire now. But I didn't think of him as this uber versatile guy. Dante Hightower, I don't think was, we didn't think of him as a jack of all trades. Chung, I guess, is a little bit, but what I'm getting at is it's quite possible this is being coached into these guys. Look at Jonathan Jones, for example. Did at any point this season, any of us, and probably anybody within the NFL, look at him and say, you know, I think he'd be pretty good at playing safety in the biggest game of the year. I think I'd like to see him there. I mean, somebody's teaching these guys how to do this. J.C. Jackson, I talked to him after the game. I guarantee you someone's working closely and teaching J.C. Jackson, because he, at least in the height of the Super Bowl glory, he was not up for talking scheme. My sense is he's a tell me what to do and I'll go do it guy, rather than a cerebral, hey, let me think about this and be a D coordinator on the field guy. Someone's coaching these players really well in New England. It can't. It's not just Belichick, because he can't coach them all one at a time. His staff must do an unbelievable job.
Yeah, and that's I think that's the one thing you wonder about a little bit going forward. Brian Flores is obviously moving on. He was the linebackers coach for a long time. He was technically only linebackers coach, even though he's making defensive calls this year. He is down in Miami now. When you have constant churn with your coaching staff, Belichick is obviously still there, but will that eventually take its toll in New England?
I mean, has it yet? They've lost a lot of guys over the years.
I guess they have. I guess that's
so. So what we have to assume, because we don't know the inner workings of the Patriots, they don't open their curtains the way some other teams do for us. Belichick's probably a great teacher for players, but also for coaches, developing coaches. But I don't know if he develops them as head coaches, because we've seen that track record. But developing them as teachers of football, which is very different than being a head coach.
All comes down to teaching. We hear
it, really
it all
does.
The time.
These guys are – everybody's athletes are great. So if someone can figure out how to teach their athletes better, they're going to gain a huge advantage, because the pieces are relatively the same from one team to the next across the NFL.
All right. Before we go into the some of the off-season stuff and then your questions, I just want to give a quick note. This is going to be our last deep dive show for a while. We'll still do the Monday show. You'll still get us every Monday. But we're going to wrap it up for the time being. We don't have games to preview or anything. We'll probably come back with an extra show around free agency and around the draft. But this will be it. You'll get us once a week for the off season, and then we'll be back with the deep dive show once next season starts. But, yeah, that's pretty much the announcement. Gambling show is going to do a wrap-up show on Friday. And then they will wrap up, well, I'm in that, so I'll say we will wrap up the gambling show until next August, and Albert and Jenny and Connor, they'll be back with the regular Wednesday stuff. They have a show, one back in your feed, if you want to go listen to it, if you can't get enough of this Super Bowl talk. But let's look ahead to the offseason a little bit. I just have one Patriots-centric question, Andy. We don't know what Rob Gronkowski is going to do. We saw what this offense was when Edelman was out early in the year. And I just kind of wonder, you take away one of the guys who demands a double team, how much does this offense slide back? You know, and obviously I don't think we expect this defense to go out and give a weekly performance like they did last week.
Yeah. I think you would slide back quite a bit with Gronkowski and Edelman. Those guys are difference makers. They're not just products of the scheme. So if Gronkowski, I don't know. I mean, as I'm thinking about it, though, we forget a few years ago he wasn't there, was he, Gary? And they still wound up going the distance without him.
He wasn't. They did have Martellus Bennett at that point.
Yeah.
We've talked about that a little bit. Martellus Bennett stylistically is a similar guy. Gronkowski, as much as people want to look at the numbers, say Gronk was down this year, and he is not quite the guy he used to be, but he's an elite blocker. I'm just not sure you can find a package like him out there in free agency. I think there's TJ Hockenson from Iowa is probably the guy in the draft who could give you a poor man's version of it, but you're probably not going to get him late in the first round.
No, and let's look, Gronkowski had 6 catches for 87 yards in this game, and it was a hard-fought game, and these were one-on-one battles he was winning. He was helped by the design a few times. They had some great play-action designs for him. But if he were wearing down the way people said, or even close to the way people said, he would not be producing like this at the end of the season. And it's a long season that you play. So I would hope he comes back, but I understand if he doesn't. If he walks away right now, Does he go down as the best tight end of all time?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, we talked about this a little bit last week. I think the answer is yes. I can't think of a great argument for any of the modern tight ends to be considered over him. Because not only, even without the blocking, he probably wouldn't quite be there without the blocking, but when you factor in the blocking, I think he clearly is.
Shannon Sharp was probably known as the best receiving team. Maybe Tony Gonzalez has surpassed him. Do you remember, because I was so young, was Sharp as formationally versatile as Gronkowski? Did Sharp play? Gronk plays offset fullback. He plays up on the line of scrimmage. He plays slot, inside slot, and he plays ex-ISO backside receiver. My guess is, I'm hearing myself ask a question, Shannon Sharp probably didn't do all that.
I don't remember him doing all that. I also did not watch all 22 film at that point in my life, and probably was flipping channels, looking for whoever I had on my fantasy team at that point. So I can't
you were
give
playing
an
fantasy back then. You were ahead of the curve. Fantasy was new back then.
I was playing fantasy in 1992. No,
all right.
Correction. I was playing fantasy in 1989. Was my first year.
Then how did you mix up 92 and 89?
92 was when one of my 92 is when my oldest league started. In 1989, we just did a league with my three brothers and my father. We did a five-person league. You played two matchups because otherwise someone would just have a bye every week. But yeah, 1989.
You know, there's also something to be said about going out early and leaving something on the table for your legend. It shouldn't impact what kind of player you were, because it's irrelevant to that conversation. But for reputation, if Gronk goes out now at the height of things, that's going to add to his lore a little bit.
It's the Barry Sanders factor, a little bit of that.
Yeah, it's exactly what it is. Yeah.
He is. I don't blame him if he walks away. The beating he takes, and he's already a guy who we kind of looked at. He had the back problem coming out of Arizona. That's why he slipped to the second round. He's a lot of man to carry on a human frame. So that already makes him sort of prone to injuries to an extent. And then he's out there every day, and people are constantly diving at his knees and his legs because that's how you have to tackle him. That's not fun. I don't think that's a very fun life to live.
After the game the other night, I walked around the corner in their locker room and accidentally, I didn't walk in on it because I didn't go back in the room they were on, but they were visible. I happened in on them. He had his pants down by his ankles showing James White how bad his thigh was. I said, sorry, fellas.
That's a scene.
Not me. Not supposed to be here.
Yeah, that's a scene. Andy, biggest contenders in the AFC. I'll boil it down to these teams, and you can add on. But next year, biggest contender, you have the Colts, ton of cap room, so they can sort of build themselves up. They have Andrew Luck. The Chiefs, similarly, you have Patrick Mahomes, and you have a chance to revamp that defense. And I think we'd agree, if they end up with a slightly above average defense next year, that team is probably the favorite. And then you have the Steelers, who are there. They have the individual talent. We'll see how it plays out with Antonio Brown this offseason. But when you look at these teams, who is most likely to make a run at the AFC title here?
Well, are you not putting the Chiefs and Chargers in that conversation?
No, I put the Chiefs in, not the Chargers, though. You can put the Chargers in if you want.
I didn't catch the Chiefs part. I would put the Chargers in. I would, and I'd probably put in the AFC's pretty thick top to bottom, wouldn't you say? It's New England and those teams that you mentioned. Figure there's going to be one breakout team. I guess we figure one or two of those teams that you mentioned will surprisingly fall off. But I think the question is, do the Colts, how quickly do they separate themselves?
Yeah, I mean, they have a ton of cap room. They have a second top 35 draft pick because of the Jets trade last year where the Jets came up to get Darnold. So they have the ability to add quite an influx of talent this offseason if they want to. And I think you just look at the number of defensive linemen who could hit the market. And obviously a lot of guys get franchise tagged, but you just kind of wonder, is someone going to slip through here? Are the Cowboys gonna tag DeMarcus Lawrence for a second time? They probably will because he's still affordable at that point. But
the Colts could use three more pass rushers. I mean, they really got away without having one this season. Their blitz packages expanded a little bit, but even down the stretch against Kansas City, when they needed their pass rush to step up, that four-man rush did not. It was nowhere to be found. So you have to figure they're going to prioritize that in free agency and the draft. The nice thing about the scheme they run defensively is because of the simplicity, theoretically, I think you can fit guys in there and have them contribute pretty quickly. I don't know if there's as much of an acclimation curve with them as there might be with a team like the Steelers, for example. And then I think anyone playing with Andrew Luck can seamlessly fit in, because Luck strikes me as a teacher on the field, a guy who makes people around him better just by the way he plays. Look at Dontrell Inman, for example, and what he did late in the season, or Eric Ebron this year, for that matter. I mean, guys, Luck is a very user-friendly quarterback. So the Colts are positioned, I would imagine, to jump up pretty quickly here, and they're jumping from already a high place.
Looking at the Rams, I mean, can other teams around the league take what the Patriots did on Sunday and say, well, here's a game plan every time we play the Rams, and, you know, obviously the Rams have a chance to adjust to it and come up with solutions, but is this a game plan that can be duplicated league-wide?
I think a little bit. A little bit, because what was so impressive was that in New England, even though they were playing six guys up front and four guys back in coverage, it didn't sacrifice a lot of their regular looks. They still got to their spots when they had to drop into coverage. Those line of scrimmage guys, Kyle Van Noy and Patrick Chung, those are athletic guys, and they were able to easily drop into space. In fact, if anything, it was easier for them because they were already aligned wider than they normally would be, so they got to the flats that much quicker. So the 6-1-4 look is – I think other teams can adopt that if they want. You still have to teach your guys how to do it and how to get to different places from it. But the idea blueprint, I guarantee you Sean McVay is going to treat it as a blueprint this year and spend a lot of extra time coming up with solutions for how to counter what he saw on Sunday.
The Saints, let's talk about the Saints real quick. I don't want to pile on the poor Saints fans who have been through a heck of a lot the last couple weeks, but Drew Brees' arm. I mean, his arm seems to be, you know, everyone looks at Brady and says, oh, Brady, he must be falling off. He's 41. You really haven't seen a physical drop-off from Brady. You're starting to see a physical drop-off from Brees, and it kind of reminds me almost of Peyton Manning his last year, where it just reached a point where he just wasn't enough of a threat pushing the ball down the field to really be playing the quarterback position at an elite level.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I can see that comparison. He's not at Manning's level yet, but I think you're saying he's on the way there. He hasn't gotten to that position. Yeah. When they struggled this season, their offense was always getting condensed. They weren't going downfield. They were dinking and dunking. I don't think they're a very good dink. I mean, they're a good enough dinking and dunking team, but they're not the same Saints. They're not the S-A-I-N-T-S all capital letter type Saints when they're dinking and dunking. And if Brees' arm is going to continue to fall off, that's a concern. But there were talks about, I remember when I went to Tyrann Mathieu's house a few years ago, he was young, so he didn't know better not to say this publicly, but we were watching Saints film, and he just said casually about Brees, it was a far hash throw, kind of the other side of the field, of the field numbers. He said, yeah, I don't think he has enough juice to make that throw. And he may have been right, but the point is, guys around the league have been talking about Drew Brees' arm strength or the decline of that for several years now. I do think we've seen a more marked decline than in recent years, but Brees has also shown that he can acclimate and adjust his game for that.
What about Marcus Davenport? This is kind of an aside, because Marcus Davenport won't make or break the Saints next year, but they traded their 2019 first-round pick to come up and get Davenport last year, who was considered a very raw prospect, but also a uniquely talented prospect.
And he got better as the season went along. I think their D-line coach, Ryan Nielsen, is one of the best ones because we've seen a lot of guys get better under him. Davenport, very big power, transitional movement power, had to learn some moves to make it all worthwhile, and he got more efficient in that way as the season went along. Do you think then, Gary, that the trade, knowing what we know now, and it was kind of a trade made for a big move in 2018,
yeah,
given that the 2019 draft has so many options at defensive end, so this was a move more about last year than this year. Do you think the trade was worthwhile for the Saints?
I think it could be. It's tough to say it is because it really didn't work out in 2018. I think there are a lot of guys you look at in 2019 and say, you know, especially where the Saints are picking. The Saints were not going to have a top five pick or so. They weren't going to get a Nick Bosa or a Josh Allen or something like that. Josh Allen being the edge rusher, not the guy who currently plays quarterback for another team. But so when you're looking at the middle and back of the first round, you're looking at similar projects. So I guess if you got a 1 year head start with your high upside edge rusher, maybe you can make this thing work a little bit faster than, you know, a guy you take at 2019 and that's his developmental year, and now you don't have him contributing until 2020.
Yeah. I'm already dreading the what do we have, about 10 years ahead of us of this Josh Allen clarification nonsense that we're going to have to deal with?
There's two Josh Allens. There's another Connor McGovern coming in, now that we talk about Connor McGovern on the show
what
a lot,
the
Broncos
odds of
offensive
that?
Lineman.
What are the chances? Josh Allen, I can understand. There's a second Connor McGovern out there. Most of our listeners probably know, but if you don't, he's the Broncos' right guard. He's a fringe starter. We'll see how good he becomes. I didn't realize there was another one of him, though.
The other Connor McGovern is also an interior lineman from Penn State. Probably going to be a day two pick. We'll see how it goes. There is also a Michael Jordan and a Michael Jackson in this draft class.
Okay. I remember the Michael Jackson wide receiver when I was a kid.
Yep.
And then the Rams actually had a Michael Jordan as a defensive back a few years ago. I think he's out of the league now, but he played for a tiny bit off the bench. Why would you do that to your kid? All you do is disappoint everybody you ever meet because they're going to think, yo, you're not the real Michael Jordan.
I occasionally see Michael Jordan. He's an interior offensive lineman from Ohio State. I occasionally see him referred to as Mike Jordan, which is a way to work around it. I don't know what his preference is or what the deal is there, but I guess we'll find out this draft season.
Yeah.
The quarterbacks, the veteran quarterbacks, and we'll talk about draft real briefly in a second. The veteran quarterbacks out there, Foles, Flacco, Bridgewater, Tannehill. If I'm missing anyone, let me know, Andy. But any of these guys, Foles would have to be on the top of the list for anyone who thinks they can take the next step with their team, correct? Like a Broncos or a Jaguars.
You put Foles ahead of Flacco?
I think so. Yes. Yeah. I do.
Let me ask it this way. On what grounds? I don't disagree with you, but it's going to be hard to reason that decision when you're the one sitting down making it. Because on what grounds do you put Foles ahead of Flacco? And you can't say he's a winner because that doesn't mean anything.
Yep.
That's a nothing statement.
Flacco was also a Super Bowl MVP, so there's not a whole lot in that. I think Flacco never quite got back to what he was after his ACL injury. I think when you look at Foles, what worries you with Foles is, can he do this outside of Philadelphia where clearly the things they were doing were making him incredibly comfortable? I don't think Foles is a guy who you can plug in anywhere. I'm not going to shock anyone with this. He's not Andrew Luck, where you can drop Andrew Luck into your system and basically it's tough to figure out a way to not have Andrew Luck be successful. You have to have the right system for Foles. I don't know if, you know, I don't know if the Jaguars have that in place right now. So we'll see. I have not trusted Flacco since the knee injury, though. I don't think he's gotten all the way back. And it's been, two full seasons now. I don't know if you can be confident he's going to get all the way back.
Yeah, and I think last year a back injury factored in a little bit, but
yeah.
I don't disagree with you. Will the money be even for those guys? Or assuming Foles is – I mean, how much does each guy cost?
That's also a good point. It looks like it's going to be a tag and trade with Foles, so you're not only – you know, giving up the money or giving up the draft pick. I think Foles, if he were just straight up open market with Flacco, I think Foles would get more money anyway. I think Flacco's viewed as damaged goods a little bit.
Okay.
I think. I could be wrong.
There's always someone who's going to fall in love with the arm, though. I mean, I've been guilty of that a lot. And it's the Matthew Stafford syndrome. Everybody thinks they're the ones that can tame the wild stallion. They're going to see, and Flacco's not wild per se, but they're going to, along those same lines of thinking, they're going to say, well, you, a guy with that kind of arm, well, my system will take care of that. Give me that guy.
Bridgewater and Tannehill. To me, let's call them bridge guys for someone who's going to take their rookie quarterback.
Let's call them tan guys if we're just going to abbreviate one of the names.
Wait, what? Say
you said
that
bridge
again?
Guys. Bridgewater, bridge guys. I don't – look,
oh,
you can't – yeah, there it is.
That was terrible.
Welcome
oh
to the very
goodness.
Average to slightly below average joke, Gary. I don't think they're in the same class at all. I think Tannehill still has a chance as a starter, and I think Bridgewater is a journeyman backup type.
Okay. All right.
The problem with all this, though, what's getting lost, there are not a lot of teams that need quarterbacks this year. I think we've counted maybe four teams are in the market truly for a QB. You could argue that there are 28 or 26 to 28 comfortable teams that are comfortable with their quarterback situation. Interestingly, though, two of the teams, I don't know if you count Denver as comfortable, Case Keenum, or if they'd rather go get one of these guys. But let's say Denver's one of the teams that's in the market for a QB. Denver and Jacksonville both have high-end playoff caliber defenses. So I could see them being a little bit more aggressive at QB, even though I'm sure people don't think of those as teams that are just one player away. Those teams can view themselves as that.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. So those are the teams that are in the market for some of these guys. And of course, the draft, it is loaded with defensive prospects, especially up front on the D-line. These teams that have been desperate for edge rushers or for some sort of pass rush presence, this is the year you can get it. The quarterbacks they're all interesting. It's not last year's class. Dwayne Haskins, I think, is kind of the total package. He's a one-year starter, and you even saw sort of mid-season last year. They had to rein things in a little bit, pull it back. They started doing a lot of screen stuff at Ohio State, and they ended up getting back on track by the end of the year. But these guys who are one-year starters, they haven't had a whole lot thrown at them that has been thrown at them for specific reasons. They just don't have enough tape out there. And especially, look, Big Ten football is I know I'm going to make some people's blood boil, but you don't get the kind of athletes in the Big Ten that you maybe get in the SEC or some of these other conferences. So Ohio State is so superior athletically to the rest of the teams in that conference. It's kind of amazing that they ever lose games in that conference, even though they seem to have a dud every year. But Haskins will be interesting. He certainly has all the tools. Drew Lock is another guy, big arm. We'll see. He actually kind of reminds me of Flacco. The way he plays. Daniel Jones, to me, I think he's a slightly taller Mitchell Trubisky. You can take that for, you know, that's the good and the bad. And Kyler Murray is obviously, he's the wild card. He's 5'9". He is an exceptional athlete. He's an exceptional arm talent. He obviously was more than capable of handling what Lincoln Riley asked him to do at Oklahoma last year. The question is going to be, you know, everyone wants him to be Russell Wilson. I don't think he is physically Russell Wilson. I don't know if he is mentally Russell Wilson. That's something I don't know firsthand, but Russell Wilson is an incredibly unique guy. He is an exception to a lot of rules, and to, you know, we heard a lot of people saying Johnny Manziel, well, he's just going to be Russell Wilson. He's not. He is physically not Russell Wilson, and obviously we saw he had all sorts of other problems, but I think it's tough to look at a guy and say, well, he'll be Russell Wilson. I don't know if we'll see a Russell Wilson again.
You remember when we hung out at the Marriott Marquis downtown Atlanta two nights before the Super Bowl?
I do. How could I forget?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes, it's been a few days. Well, you were drinking pretty heavily. I thought maybe you'd forget that way. But
I can handle that stuff.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you weren't drinking that heavily.
No, I was drinking heavily, but I can handle it.
Yeah, you know, you were very professional still. But I went back there the next night when I was waiting for you guys to come join us at the come join me. I picked up the SI Party wristbands and then had to wait on you guys to get your Uber downtown. I went back and just sat in that same lounge, and I saw Greg Cosell there from NFL Films. He was there with his daughter, and the Kyler Murray came up, and I told him I haven't seen him. I don't know anything about him, but I imagine you've watched him. What do you see? And he told me, and maybe he doesn't want me saying this yet because he's probably still evaluating him, but on quick glance, Kyler Murray's got a livelier arm than Russell Wilson, and he's a more dynamic athlete than Russell Wilson.
What I worry about is he is, one, I mean, we'll see what he weighs in at. He looks like he's about 180 pounds. Russell Wilson is sort of built, you know, he can almost be a running back the way he's built. And Russell Wilson, obviously, is aggressively aware of avoiding hits and taking care of himself out there. Russell Wilson, I think, just maps the field in a way when he's on the move that, you know, it's almost like I'd compare it to a great point guard who can drive the lane and be among all this chaos and still know where everyone else is on the floor. Russell Wilson is almost that way with the way he's able to map defenders and his teammates on the field. I think it's a unique skill that might only be, you know, basically applied to Russell Wilson and maybe not to anyone else at this point.
Yeah, you've got to be able to get outside the pocket a certain way to be Russell Wilson. It's not just the ability to do that. It's then the ability to see and manipulate the field once you do. And then there's also the fine line of when are you choosing to get out of the pocket? Is it at the appropriate time? And that's where the Russell Wilson conversation has always gotten complicated. But these guys are not easy to translate to the NFL. Even though we're starting to have these conversations more, Baker Mayfield a few years ago would never have been considered a first-round caliber guy, let alone the first overall pick, and that's like that looks like it's working out pretty well. So I think minds are expanding here, but they're going to have to expand responsibly because just as easily as you're Baker Mayfield, you can draft the next Johnny Manziel, I'm talking on-the-field Manziel, type of, you know, an erratic, irresponsible quarterback.
We shall see. We'll have a whole draft season to talk about it. Kyler Murray, and this is obviously still, we're assuming at this point he's going to choose the NFL. That is not a done deal yet either. So perhaps we will never talk about Kyler Murray again as he goes off to a career in professional baseball. But yeah, I'm just very wary of anyone being billed as he'll just be Russell Wilson. I don't think it's that easy. Let's go to the mailbag. We got a couple questions here to get in. This one's from Mike. Is there anything to make from the fact that the 2018 Patriots, who by all accounts were not as well-oiled a machine as previous years, lost to only non-playoff teams? As a fan of them, I took solace in this fact before each playoff game against what I felt like were superior teams. It just strikes me as an odd thing. It's not like they lost a couple of games or had a meaningless Week 17 loss or lost all the games in a particular part of the season, even while establishing an identity or anything like that. Do you all think that they had trouble getting up for those games against lesser opponents, or is there something schematically that those five teams did that other more successful teams could somehow replicate?
Well, I think this is just a mark in the pro side for my strength of schedule argument. That's all this is.
It very well could be, and we should mention that the games that the Patriots lost this year, they lost to Jacksonville. We all remember that when Jacksonville won the Super Bowl back in Week 2, they lost at Detroit. That was the Matt Patricia game, where we kind of talked about how Patricia was maybe a little more familiar with their strengths and weaknesses than most, and those two losses also were without Julian Edelman at that point. They lost at Tennessee. They got blown out at Tennessee, 34-10. They lost the Miracle Miami game, which, look, you know, the Dolphins, yes, they won on a last-second lateral play, but Dolphins also put up 28 points before that play, and they lost at Pittsburgh. That game that the Steelers had to have, that was 17-10. And, those are your five losses there. I don't know. I don't know if you could find a common thread between those.
think the common thread is they're all NFL teams and they're all really good. It's Patricia and the Lions, he had them well coached that game. Jacksonville's an elite defense talent-wise. Miami's a familiar division foe. They've actually always played New England pretty tough, especially under Adam Gase. Pittsburgh is more talented and probably better equipped than a lot of those playoff teams in the AFC this year. They just underachieved in Pittsburgh. And Tennessee just kicked their butt schematically that day. They showed a lot of different zone exchanges into cover three, and Tom Brady was never comfortable with it. So it's not like these were the closest one would be the Miami game that was a fluke ending, you could argue. I don't think it was a fluke end. It was fluky, but let's remember New England had a bad move putting Gronkowski on the field at free safety in that play. So it's there's a reason and an explanation for all these games, and I don't think there's a common thread either. It's the NFL, and that's why half the teams that made the playoffs this year aren't going to make them next year, and that's why you have to bring it every week, even if you are the New England Patriots, who, by the way, have lost the Super Bowl or failed to win it in two-thirds of their years under Brady and Belichick together still.
That is correct. And I should add real quick, we did a series at the MMQB on sort of the Patriots process and some of the things that we see year in and year out with them, and they do treat the season like a process, and part of the reason they are able to do that, and this is kind of lucky on their part, AFC East has never been very good, or it has rarely been very good in the years they've been in it. So I don't think they go into the season saying, well, we can win this at 9-7 or something like that, but most years they probably could. They have a margin of error that's larger than most contenders during the regular season. I'd say that.
See, but when you're saying that, it seems like you're implying that they do go in and say, well, 9-7, there's room to breathe there.
Maybe not 9-7 extreme. I think they understand that they can lose a game or two in the first quarter of the season, first third of the season, and have time to make up for it.
Well, but that's true of every team still. There's no team that's lost a game in September and thought, oh, man, now we're done. We're too far behind.
But there are teams that would lose a game or two in September and say, boy, we're really behind the eight ball now.
Okay, so that's what I just said, and you're saying the opposite. So you disagree with me.
I do disagree with you.
I would argue back it's a chicken or egg thing, but those teams having that response is why they are those teams and not the Patriots. Any team that thinks September makes or breaks their season, that's a stupid team. That's a dumb way to look at it.
But I think it's tough to approach the season and say it's okay if we're a little bit sloppy in the first third of the season.
But that's not how they look at it. Okay, they're not going to say it's okay if we're a little bit sloppy. They're going to say we're building to something.
Yes,
it's a Matt Eberflus thing. Matt Eberflus had the Colts build to something, and he committed to that, and it worked out well. Most teams probably don't have the guts to do it that way.
Yes, but I'm saying the building to something, you can spin it positively that way. But saying we're building to something implies that perhaps we will have some slip-ups early on while we build. How is that?
Mm-hmm.
How is that phrasing?
Oh, that's fine. I can imagine a coach saying that as he bangs the lockers for a week two game and says, let's go out there, fellas.
let's go build something.
Let's lay a good portion of what we have out there on the field today.
Andy, can't win with you. Kurt Wiesenberger. Can you explain why he is asking this question, by the way? I'm not just saying that out loud. Can you explain why offensive linemen are allowed to continue moving in the set position at the line? The rule states that they have to hold the set position for a full second before the ball is snapped. But I often see linemen moving hands and arms up until the ball is hiked. The right guard, number 66 of the Rams, Austin Blythe, I believe he is referring to, is especially guilty of this. I assume they are pointing out the mic or calling blocking play. It seems like a big advantage over the defense, as the defense can't react to that movement but need to react to the play as quickly as possible. I mean, we're talking about false starts here.
Or the lack of them. I've kind of wondered this myself, and Austin Blythe's not the one making the protection call, so I don't know why he's doing that, or if that's...
I think they were doing some silent counts. I thought.
Okay, so maybe Blythe is the guy. Ramon Foster is the guy that taps the center's leg in Pittsburgh when they're ready to snap the ball. Maybe it's, I mean, I don't know. I'd have to look at that. Whatever it is, I've wondered that too. A lot of gesticulating happens from offensive linemen. You never see defensive linemen react to it, though. A false start is when you lift up out of your stance. There's a vertical or a forward nature to it. It comes from your legs, not from your arms. But it is interesting that a little flinch is a false start, but if you move your entire arm to point at the guy, it's not a false start. That's what's interesting, but also it's treated that way. You don't see defenders jump when the guy moves his arm, and I don't know why that is. You have to play football to know. I'm sure there's a reason for it, though.
Now, there was a college team, I want to say it was like 5 years ago, and I'm sorry for being so vague on this, but they were running a play where basically, you know, if it was 4th and 3, they would line up with a punt team, and then they would do a full line shift. Everyone would pop up at the same time and shift over one or whatever they were doing, and it was drawing teams offsides a little while. And then finally, one time, the officials threw a flag on it and called it a false start, which I think is, if you're talking about the spirit of the rules, they were clearly trying to simulate the start of a play with this giant shift. And I'm all for that. I'm all for enforcing the rules as they are intended to be enforced.
I am too. I don't like I want creativity to come within the formation and after the snap. I don't want it to come with the gimmicks. I guess I kind of talked myself backwards there, though, because I said the formation, but I don't like that jumbo stuff either. We just saw the Patriots and Rams. They lined up and they beat the crap out of the offense by scheming it. It was nothing. There's no gimmicks, no tricks, no trades. It was just playing football. There's ways to do it still. So I like that. Well, we were going to write that article about how Taylor Decker should never have been allowed to catch that pass against the Rams back in Week 13.
We might still do it. I want to hear
I
from
think
Mark
we still
Barron
need
on
to.
That. Mark
yeah,
Barron
I feel that way. We should have done that last week. Why didn't we work on that last week?
Oh, that's right. We could have found Mark Barron. Oh, we'll get him this offseason. He was, if you go back and watch that highlight, Mark Barron is beside himself with how absurd that whole situation was. One more, Andy. Tom from East Hampton. I know you're going to like this one. I appreciate this one from Tom. I'll just say it. I'll say it right at the top. So Tom writes, I have fixed overtime. You're welcome. No one can seem to figure out how to eliminate the coin toss while also getting rid of any advantage or disadvantage that may come from a team going first or second in overtime. We talked about that. If we were to say equal possessions, you would obviously want to be the second team because you want to see what you need, whether you need a field goal to tie it or win it or a touchdown to tie it, et cetera. Tom's idea gets rid of the coin toss and no one goes first or second. Tom writes, I propose that in overtime, each team gets the ball at the opponent's 20-yard line at the same time. There is no down and distance and no clock. Both offenses are on the field and they start playing at the whistle, and the first team that scores a touchdown wins. If you turn the ball over, you have to start over 5 yards further back each time. Not enough refs, who cares? The plan maximizes viewing pleasure, the split screen insanity, coaches and fans going nuts, not enough refs to watch both plays on the field, and just a ton of crazy hurry up offense plays. The plan is fair and awesome, and if you don't agree, you just hate fun. Thanks in advance for making this the official overtime proposal of the MMQB podcast. I love it. If you're not gonna do the rule correctly, just do chaos, entertainment.
And my sense is this is just one big conspiracy to get me to react from you and from Tom from East Hampton. I mean, I'm thinking of all kinds of analogies that I could equate to how befuddlingly stupid and ridiculous this idea is, but I don't think I need to even bother with it because there's no possible way that a listener of ours would think like this.
If anyone from
and
the
I know
XFL,
you would not agree with it. You would not. You just said you don't like the left tackle passes.
If anyone from the XFL is listening to this, they just got an idea of how they're going to do overtime. Can we agree on that?
We could end on a stronger question than Tom from East Hampton here.
it wasn't even a question, Andy. He's just telling you how to do it.
Yeah, this is an unsolicited idea 4 weeks too late, which is good because it would have gotten really embarrassed if it was put up against the other overtime ideas that we got emailed to us. This is a really weak ending to the show. And it's all on Tom from East Hampton, and it's all on you because you're the one that decides which of these questions we do. So it's half on Tom and half on you, I guess. That's probably what's fair.
I think this is somehow a more fitting way to end the season for the Deep Dive Podcast.
Which, Tom from East Hampton should have to put his last name on this. His friends and family should have to see this idea.
Shame. No, I think it was the right way to end this season. This season of the NFL Deep Dive Podcast. Like I said, we'll be back sporadically around free agency and around draft time. We'll still have a couple episodes, but you will have to settle for us just once a week on the Monday morning NFL podcast. And also, you'll still get Albert Breer and Jenny Vrentas and Connor Orr on Wednesdays. Andy's just fuming now. We can't see each other right now, but I can hear the smoke, the flames just shooting out of his ears right now as his brain overheats with anger.
I'm not going to give him – I guess I've already given him the reaction he wants. But I don't take the idea seriously enough to have a real emotion about it.
I don't think it was a very serious proposal, but I like the idea of just going with complete chaos if you're going to do it as poorly as the NFL currently does over time.
It's not that poor. Oh, all right, see, I'm giving in. This is what people do to me. It's people who are my friends do this to me a lot.
It's too easy, Andy.
I know.
This is the comparison I make. When we talked about the MVP race and Patrick Mahomes beating Drew Brees and Saints fans would get upset and say, you're talking like Mahomes is so much better than Brees. Mahomes wasn't so much better than Brees. Just Mahomes was better than Brees. He was objectively better than Brees. That's why it couldn't be Brees' year. It had to be Mahomes. It just like if I had $5 and you had $4, I don't have way more money than you, and that is probably approximately what is in our respective bank accounts. I don't have way more money, but I do have more money. I clearly, five is more than four. So the NFL overtime rules, it's not the worst rules in the world. It's not this outrageous thing that they did so wrong, but they're clearly doing it wrong. There are clearly better ways to do it. They could have $5 instead of $4 if they wanted to. Just the competition committee doesn't, they move at a glacial pace, and that's why we have what we have.
I don't recall us ever quite figuring out the overtime thing for them. I recall us talking about it, but not coming up with the perfect idea, unless you wanted to do my idea, which we'd never fully enacted, of course.
We gave them so many alternatives that are better than what they currently have now. They can pick and choose. There ended up being a bunch that I still like mine the most because I went ahead and put the best idea out first. But
what was yours idea again?
Alternating possessions, but first of all, get rid of overtime regular season. We don't need it. If you tie in the regular season, it's just a tie. That's just the way life goes.
That stinks. You did not say that originally. No. That smells bad.
No. You agreed with me when I first put this out. You play 60 minutes of football in the regular season and you're tied. It's a tie game. That's it.
No, I do not agree with that. No. What's the other part of it, though?
Now I got to comb through the old episodes to find you agreeing with me.
I didn't agree with that.
I'm talking about playoffs only. You have equal possessions, but the home team, the team that earned the higher seed during the regular season, gets to go second on the first possession of overtime.
That was my idea. That's not your idea. That's my idea.
It is not. That was your idea.
You are Donald Trumping me right now.
No, wait. Okay, a couple of things. Number one, I don't think that's what Donald Trump does. He does other stuff. Number two, I didn't incept you on this. I put forward, you were fine just having it be the same for the most part, if I remember correctly. Now I got to go listen to
said
our old
I don't,
episodes.
I don't hate the way it is, but I understand we could improve it, and then I came up with that perfect
and then
idea
you wanted
how to
the
improve
yardage.
It, and now you're saying you did
yes.
it.
No, you wanted the yardage. I'm saying
that was my second idea. That was my second idea. The playoff idea, though, for home field, that was the first idea. But you still have to figure out what you do about the regular season and how you decide it. And that's where I floated the yardage idea, which is still better than your idea, which is literally nothing now. You're saying no overtime for the regular season.
Yeah,
just everything's a tie.
I'm saying you played 60 minutes and you had the same score. Good job. Everyone gets a tie.
No.
Nice work, guys.
No. I don't mind ties, but you have to have an overtime period in there still.
I don't think so.
I know you don't think so, but I don't think you think period on this stuff.
Well, now I got to go back and go over our old episodes and see how we came to that conclusion of doing alternating with the home team getting second possession.
I know a way we can make that easy. Let's just tell if a listener can send us an audio clip figuring out the same argument for us, we will then read any question they ask. We'll go on the air and we'll read any question they ask, even if it's as dumb as Tom from East Hampton's question.
Tom from East Hampton, please win this contest.
No, and if someone can prove who's right or wrong, I don't think Gary ever. I certainly did not agree to overtime being just eradicated from the regular season. If somebody can find me doing that, or even not doing it, if someone can solve this, then they get carte blanche for 3 minutes on our show. We'll read whatever they want us to read.
Okay, deal. Be our researchers. It's not even
and
research.
By the way,
if we get nothing. Said.
Yes, but if we get nothing, then I win that argument because that means it didn't exist.
Oh, that
means you never proposed, you never floated the idea of no overtime.
And then we just probably talked about it off the air. That's what I'll claim. Donald Trump.
We never talked about it off the air. Why would we have talked about that? We don't talk about that stuff off the air.
We rarely talk off the air.
That's right. Yeah. I wouldn't even room with you at the Super Bowl.
That's how it went down. See, do you feel better about this ending now?
Versus a Tom from East Hampton ending?
Yeah.
This beats that. This is more fun.
I still appreciate what Tom sent. All right, that's going to do it. Thanks to our researchers, Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor, who make us sound smart every week. Yeah, that's right. Thank you, as always, to producer Shelby Royston and the guys at Cadence 13 who make us sound good. Most of all, thank you to you guys for listening to this episode and really the whole season of the MMQB NFL Deep Dive podcast. Like I've said a couple times now, we will come back with an extra show around free agency, around draft, so we're not completely going away with two shows a week, but you'll just get us on Monday. You will get Albert, Jenny, and Connor on Wednesday, and that'll be it for the offseason until next August or September. So if you don't already, go ahead and subscribe to the MMQB Podcast Network, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, radio.com/10things, and other podcast providers. We'll see you guys on Monday.